following program is a production of KUSC, Los Angeles.
I find it very difficult to take seriously most of the stuff that other people in this country just believe in. I can't buy it. I'm not wild about sports. Beer, I can take it or leave it. Religion, give me a break. Politics, ha ha ha. I can't honestly pretend to be one of the people that thinks that everything is okay. Because from where I stand, it's not okay. And the best I can do is laugh about it because I sure can't fix it.
Tell you it's outrageous filth. So I'll be looking from this senator's standpoint, not just to bring pressures, but to try to see if there is some constitutional provisions, a tax, or approach that can be used on the Congress to limit this outrageous filth.
Senator Tribble.
On one of his most recent recordings, Frank Zappa poked fun at those who would censor rock lyrics by affixing the following warning label to the album. Contains material which a truly free society would neither fear nor suppress. The language and concepts contained herein are guaranteed not to cause eternal torment in the place where the guy with the horns and pointed stick conducts his business. Zappa has always conducted the business of making music with tongue firmly planted in cheek. A great mocker of convention, he's been called the unlikeliest rock star this or any other country has ever produced. Yet for all his racy irreverence, Frank Zappa is easily one of the most influential rock musicians of the past 20 years. In many ways, he defies categorization. An icon of rock, he deplores drug use and spends much of his time writing symphonic or so-called serious music. Few composers in any genre can match his productivity. He's recorded more than 50 albums, many of which have shattered rock musical conventions, while capturing the imagination of such contemporary music giants as Pierre Boulez. Zappa has also written 4 ballets, 2 feature-length films, and a pair of TV specials. But Frank Zappa's passions are not just musical. A lone wolf who unwaveringly stands by his convictions, Zappa has testified at congressional hearings on First Amendment rights. He's rallied for teenage voter registration and railed against stupidity, which he calls the basic building block of the universe. This is Gail Eichenthal, welcoming you to Barking Pumpkin, the life and times of Frank Zappa. Frank Vincent Zappa was born in Baltimore, December 21st, 1940. Since his father worked as a scientist for various aircraft corporations and the U.S. government, the Zappa family moved often, eventually settling in California, though they continued to change addresses within the state. In all, Frank Zappa attended 4 different high schools. The constant change of scenery left its mark. Zappa never had a chance to become a part of the crowd at any of those schools, and so he developed his own interests. He began his musical career as a producer in a makeshift studio, working with such performers as Lenny Bruce, the rock group The Animals, Captain Beefheart before his magic band days, and the busking street singer Wild Man Fisher. But the guitar would become Zappa's principal instrument for the next 20 years. In 1964, he started playing with a rhythm and blues band called the Soul Giants. Later that year, the group got a Hollywood manager, Herb Cohen. On Mother's Day, they officially changed their name to the Mothers. But when the band recorded its first album, MGM record executives insisted the name of the group had to be changed. They were convinced no disc jockey in the country would play anything by a group called the Mothers. So, as Frank Zappa puts it, out of necessity, they became the Mothers of Invention. Freak Out, Frank Zappa's first album with the Mothers of Invention, broke ground in 2 important ways. It was at once the first so-called concept album, in which a succession of songs created a running commentary, in this case on the absurdity of the American way of life. Freak Out is also believed to be the first double rock album. Avoiding the kind of syrupy ballads that were streaking to the top of the pop music charts at the time, the Mothers of Invention had a predilection for such titles as Wowie Zowie, Who Are the Brain Police, and The Return of the Son of Monster Magnet. From the beginning, Zappa challenged his musicians by incorporating unusually complex rhythms and harmonies, not to mention lyrics, into his songs. Playing this sort of thing live wasn't easy, and Zappa expected nothing short of perfection from his fellow musicians. Dick Barber served as road manager for the Mothers of Invention for 8 years.
Everybody got used to it, that perfection. It was kind of standard procedure that, like not many other pop bands that were working at the time, we would go in and do fairly extensive sound check, sometimes extensive rehearsal before each show, which, you know, was demanding and meant several hours in the afternoon of practice and rehearsal. The music was very complicated, and of course he demanded that the musicians had quite a large repertoire of things they could play, and they would, very few times did Frank, I think, even himself know what he was going to play when he walked out on the stage, so he'd kind of play it by ear and assemble the show as it went on, and consequently everybody had to be very aware of what was going on and what Frank might come up with for a new thing every night. I might add that the other thing that the performers enjoyed about working with Frank was that there were times during the show where they were allowed to improvise on their particular instruments to the utmost, and Frank really encouraged that, and that made the shows exciting, I think, from the standpoint of the audience, one, and almost more so from those of us who were there every night, because you knew it wasn't going to be the same show. I had occasion to work with a number of other acts during the time period who did great jobs of performing, and for the most part did the same show every night, even the same kind of banter with the audience. But with Frank, nobody knew, and I think that included Frank, what was going to happen from one night to the next.
In his desire to make every show unique, Zappa had the audacity to borrow some techniques of improvisational comedy.
We actually asked people in the audience to call out time signatures and melody notes and chord changes and assign those to different members of the band. And on the downbeat, everybody played different stuff, and amazingly it sounded pretty palatable, in fact quite exciting, and of course it was indicative of the quality of the players in the group that they could handle that with relative ease.
Always the independent thinker, Frank Zappa somehow managed to escape the most dangerous trap of the freewheeling 60s.
A lot of people think he's a drug-crazed maniac, but in fact he smokes Winston's and drinks coffee, and that's about it. And he wanted everybody around him to be relatively straight during a period when it was not very fashionable to do that. I think his personal feeling was that drugs didn't really enhance anybody's performance or artistic ability, and he didn't want that around him.
Dick Barber. Even while perched at the vanguard of the rock world, Zappa was quietly dabbling in serious music. The attraction was sparked by a chance discovery. At the age of 13, Zappa literally stumbled on a piece by the maverick 20th century French composer Edgar Varèse, creator of such revolutionary scores as Density 21.5 and Zappa's own favorite, Ionization, completed in 1932 and scored for 37 percussion instruments.
I read an article in Look magazine about Sam Goody's record store, and it said that Sam Goody was such a hero because he was a great merchandiser. He could even sell this album that had the ugliest music in the world on it, and that was the description of the Varèse album. You know, the writer made the album sound so awful, I just had to go out and find it and see, you know, what could possibly be that awful on a record. And I found it by accident in the hi-fi store in La Mesa, California. There was no surprise because I didn't have any normal music training, so there was no normality to compare it to. because I had no interest in any kind of classical music before that time, so I didn't listen to it and say, why, this sounds different than Mozart, so I should think of it a certain way. I just heard it and liked it.
The second section of Zappa's three-movement work, Help, I'm a Rock, is subtitled In Memoriam, Edgar Varèse. Composer and radio producer Charles Armerkanian.
His music is a kind of extension of the music of Edgar Varèse. And it points to a direction that might have been taken by Varèse 30 years after he had died. And it extends what some of Varèse's ideas of using modules of sound and phrases that stand independently as pieces do in a sculptural mobile. So there is, rather than one long line in Varèse, a series of independent phrase groups which appear and reappear in various slightly modified forms. And it seems to me that Zappa is doing that himself in some of his orchestra music. I don't mean that he's not original in any sense. I just mean that it's kind of nice to see a connection. Many people have written orchestral music and they've extended traditions which have been more familiar, but here is the composer Varèse, who is extremely independent. His language is very recognizable, and he didn't form a school. There was no series of followers who took his ideas and carried them on the way Frank has done.
His music isn't exactly rock and roll.
Composer David Raxon.
Frank is a highly sophisticated 12-tone composer getting by as a rock guy. And that he is able to do this is incredible, because the complexity of his music demands fabulous players, and it demands a degree of memorization which is almost impossible to conceive any place else. And he gets these amazing orchestras of wonderful players who can play unheard of things. And a lot of his music is 12-tone music with a very sophisticated kind of beat.
Zappa's discovery of the music of Varèse led the way to his appreciation of other 20th century composers. He began to buy recordings of works by Stravinsky, Webern, Ives, and Stockhausen. By meticulously studying these scores, Zappa became well-versed in the language of contemporary music. As a result, he wrote a score called 200 Motels, which was influenced by Penderecki, Ligeti, Webern, and George Antheil. In 1971, Zappa's seriousness and dedication attracted the attention of conductor Zubin Mehta, then music director of the Los Angeles Philharmonic.
I was very impressed by this young pop musician who I thought took great trouble during his very successful tours with his ensemble called the Mothers of Invention, that he wasn't quite satisfied in just sitting in his motel room and giving his successful concerts to his adoring fans every night in another city in America, but he researched music of people like Stravinsky, Bartok, and Varèse, and he discussed that with me. And I was so impressed, I said, well, listen, why don't you write something and we can perform it together? And he happened to have this piece in his hip pocket for his group and a symphony orchestra. And flexible as I sort of used to be more than I am today, I said, well, let's just do it.
Gentlemen!
Two hundred motels!
Life on the road!
dwarf.
Frank Zappa's music from the movie 200 Motels, recorded by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, led by Elgar Howarth. Zappa performed the same score with Zubin Mehta and the Los Angeles Philharmonic at an infamous concert at UCLA in 1971. Another venerable figure from the classical world became a kind of elderly soulmate for Zappa. It was composer, conductor, musicologist, and lexicographer Nicholas Leninsky who led the world premieres of such works as Ionization by Varese and Ives Three Places in New England. This great champion of new music has also written important reference books, including The Thesaurus of Scales and Musical Patterns, an encyclopedia of notation, which Frank Zappa studied avidly. Nicholas Leninsky.
I was greatly flattered by the fact that he used my book, the last thing in the world. At that time, I expected that a rock and roll player would be interested in a book like that, which is complicated and rather advanced as far as modern music is concerned.
Composer clarinetist David Ocker worked as Frank Zappa's copyist for 8 years.
When he met Leninsky, they hit it off immediately. Nicholas Leninsky, who is famous for being the guy who cataloged every possible interval and scale. And the two were exactly on the same wavelength because they're both dealing with these sort of number, pitch, and rhythm games in very different ways.
The day he met the then 87-year-old Nicholas Leninsky in 1981, Zappa impulsively asked him to appear as soloist at his group's upcoming concert the very next night. Leninsky was to play the electric piano for the first time. They agreed that under the circumstances, Leninsky would play his own composition called Minitudes, and the band would do its best to accompany him.
Zappa introduced me and described me as national treasure. Then I sat down at the piano and I was amazed that he could conduct it with practically no preparation by just indicating entrances to his musicians. And my piece, while not as complicated as Varese's music, but it was based on my system of scales and arpeggios and triads and God knows what, according to my book of scales. And he just picked it up, and the orchestra picked it up wonderfully well. And you see, when I give exhibitions of my music, I expect an audience to count about 17 people. I mean, maybe not 17 now, it's a little better. But there in the Coliseum, of course, there was a full house, you know, and I was greeted with great applause. I mean, they would have applauded anybody, you know. And then I finished, and boy, did I get an ovation. I mean, nothing like that happened in my life.
In addition to Nicholas Leninsky, the complicated rhythms and unconventional melodic lines of Zappa's symphonic works have attracted such prominent contemporary music figures as conductors Pierre Boulez and Kent Nagano. Composer Carl Stone.
There is a technical virtuosity that he demands that I think challenges people like Nagano and Boulez so that it's interesting work for them to perform. He has a fine ear. And it's an unusual music, and I think perhaps they, Boulez especially, have a perverse fascination with someone who is as celebrated as Zappa is in the popular music world, can write music that is reasonably acceptable in the classical music world.
Composer and conductor Pierre Boulez.
I think that's his originality, because he's unique. You know, you don't find many people like him in the rock world. I mean, certainly, first, he's provocative. Second, he's very independent. He does not really belong to this kind of show business, which is just making money and making money and making success. I think he's a man of his own who was never taken by the kind of commercial grind mill. And therefore, I find him very interesting. And he has also the culture of, not only of what he did, but also the culture of, let's say, quote-unquote, the classical culture, but without having the burden of the classical culture. Because we classical, so-called classical musicians, we have always this history who is weighing on us, you know, many centuries of music. Therefore, it's difficult for us to get out of it, to be really independent. And I think that's quite difficult. But, I mean, in the world of rock, they have really no pressure from this point of view. They are much more independent from the very beginning. So, therefore, I mean, we can observe them and, you know, have the opportunity to look at what they are doing from the sound point of view, of course, and from the expression point of view. There is a vitality there you don't find very much in classical music. And I like vitality above all.
Introduce himself to Pierre Boulez, Frank Zappa had sent the conductor the score to one of his latest orchestral works. Instead, Boulez chose to commission Zappa to write a piece for his Ensemble Intercontemporain, the resident performing organization of IRCOM in Paris, the most advanced new music center in the world. The commission resulted in the album The Perfect Stranger. While serving as chief guest conductor of the Ensemble Intercontemporain at IRCOM, Kent Nagano, who had known of Frank Zappa the rock star, became aware of Zappa the serious composer. Nagano quickly became a convert, a passionate champion of Zappa's symphonic works. He's already recorded two albums of Zappa's music with the London Symphony Orchestra, including such pieces as Bogus Pomp, Strictly Genteel, and Moe and Herb's Vacation.
They're tone poems, in fact, that tell stories written within the symphonic medium.
Conductor Kent Nagano.
But whether or not you would like to call them classical is about as vague a nomenclature as you would call his music rock or jazz. I mean, it's Frank Zappa's own particular form of art that he's making.
Moe and Herb wouldn't have happened.
Clarinetist David Ocker.
If I hadn't asked for a piece of solo clarinet music, just clarinet, an audience, basically. And Frank doesn't think in small terms. And it kept growing. The music is probably some of the most difficult Frank Zappa to listen to understand of anything that he's written. He's got whole groups of orchestra players playing complex atonal lines and doing 17 over 4 or 13 over 4 or, you know, things like that.
One thing that Zappa is really noted for are his complex treatment of rhythms. Basically, it seems to me what he does is codify some of the essential nature of improvisation and codifies them into extremely complex simultaneous rhythms which happen. So you have things like an even pulse of four, which is going by, that you have to divide carefully into 17 subdivisions to put that carefully against another coexisting rhythm, which is maybe going at 15. So you have four against 17 against 15, which is normally doable if you treat it as more of a fluid or free interpretation. But the way that Zappa notates this into his scores, he notates them structurally in such a way that they have to be exactly metrically put together because of the various orchestral doublings that take place. Once these rhythms are finally mastered, and it does take some time to get used to them, it is the most emancipating feeling in the world to be able to, without batting an eyelash, feel totally comfortable with a whole new level of intricacy in your personal rhythmic language. I mean, it did a lot of just personal development good for me, because after I had worked on those scores for a period of months, I had a profoundly deeper understanding of what is possible within a rhythmic language.
He does write in a language that's not terribly common to most of us who work within the symphonic field. I don't think that the rhythms are impossible because, I mean, they were created by a human, and they were created not just to be difficult, they were created with a true aesthetic in mind. I mean, he writes what he wants to hear. He writes what he hears in his head, as all true composers do, and not as a mathematical exercise. I think it's thoroughly energizing when they are played correctly, but it does imply a long period of rehearsal. And it's that long period of rehearsal, which usually for financial reasons, that makes the performance of his music extremely difficult and extremely rare. With the amount of rehearsal time that normally is affordable, what it results in oftentimes poor performances of his music, which is completely and understandably ungratifying for both the composer and the person who's conducting the score.
Kent Nagano's frustration about the lack of adequate rehearsal time is shared by Frank Zappa. Zappa openly airs his disappointment in hearing far too many underprepared performances of his music. In the liner notes for his second volume of symphonic works performed by the London Symphony Orchestra, Zappa admits he postponed the release of the album in the hopes that new technology would be developed to overcome, as he put it, the human element in order to conceal the evils lurking on the master tapes. In his quest for accurate performances of his scores, Zappa has said that he now writes exclusively for the synclavier, a computerized keyboard and synthesizer with the most advanced technical capabilities. This machine allows the composer to write and to realize electronically music which is impossible for human beings to play. A noted composer of electronic music in his own right, Carl Stone believes that with this state-of-the-art equipment, Frank Zappa has truly found his medium.
It's not as if his orchestral music is totally beloved in the contemporary classical music community. He's been criticized, and I think somewhat correctly, that the music formally has some problems. It's sort of like Hindemith to me, perhaps more interesting to perform than to listen to. However, I think his synclavier music, the work that he has turned to of late, that he, I think, has abandoned everything else in favor of, is something very unique. He has found his voice, and I enjoy it very much. I could listen to it much more readily and much more consistently and over again, which I really can't do to the same degree with his orchestral and chamber music. That's not to say that I think that those musics are bad. I just don't think that they've achieved the same level that he has with his electronic music.
Jazz from Hell, a synclavier piece from Frank Zappa's Grammy Award-winning album of the same name. Beyond satisfying his desire for note-perfect performances of his own works, the synclavier has enabled Zappa to experiment freely with his favorite musical element.
My fascination with timbre is at least on the same level as Varese's, because his music is very timbre-dependent. You couldn't take a Varese score and change the instruments around and get the same sonic result. He was very scientific about the way he combined things, how loud they played the notes, and the concern for the overtone structure that would result from a chord that was played in just a certain way. So I'm fascinated with timbre, and that's one of the things that the synclavier lets you do, is experiment around with exchanging timbres. You can write a melodic line just like you write a normal piece of music, but you have the option of hearing it played by any instrument you want just by pushing a few buttons. And the differences can be astonishing. And so after you've done all the experimentation to get the right instruments playing the right notes, you can create a very interesting type of music. Synclavier as a piece of machinery is ungodly expensive. It costs as much as a house. If you can get over that hurdle, and that's quite a hurdle, you can do some very interesting things with it. But after you've done your interesting things, the problem is, what are you going to do with your interesting things? Who's interested besides yourself? You know, that's the real hurdle to get over, because the only way that you can rationalize spending that kind of money on any piece of audio equipment is to find some way to derive income from what you're doing on it. And so far, I wouldn't say that I've derived anywhere near the cost of the machinery based on the amount of times that I've used it on a record or the sales of the records on which it was used. But if you compare that to the cost and the human turmoil of hiring musicians, I'd say that if you're going to have to be a composer, you're probably safer with the machine. There are good things about playing with a live group, and there are bad things about playing with a live group. And for the kind of music that I'm writing on the machine, I can't imagine, first of all, that there is anybody who could actually play the stuff that the machine is playing. It's just too complicated. And for that type of stuff, the machine is fabulous.
Though Frank Zappa seems content to live out his compositional life sitting at the synclavier, he has, in the past at least, wavered. Composer Charles Armakanian.
I don't know that Zappa has given up on performers altogether, because he makes pronouncements every couple of years that he's no longer going to tour, that he's no longer going to compose for humans, etc., etc. And he always comes back to doing all those activities. The fact is that he's a very busy person who simply can't clone himself, because he is sui generis. He's one of a kind, and there simply isn't anybody else who can do his work for him. So for him to have to be able to tour as a guitarist, to be able to compose, to do the writing that he does, prose and plays and so forth, to do the many activities he does, he simply has to focus on one or another for various periods of time. And so I trust that someday, as the standards of performers rise to his standards in composition, that you'll find him writing pieces of music that will be performed live.
At the infamous Paris premiere of the ballet The Rite of Spring in 1913, both the musicians and the dancers found Stravinsky's rhythms all but unperformable. Today, The Rite of Spring is played at the Hollywood Bowl every summer. It's considered a mainstream orchestral work. So it might not be too far-fetched to think that someday humans will be able to perform Zappa's unplayable music. Again, David Ocker.
I was privileged the way few people probably will ever be to actually see sketches, see revisions, to see his theoretical methods. Frank has very complex theoretical basis for a lot of his orchestral music. And also, when I went to work for him, I could play a quintuplet. When I quit working for him, I could play 17 uplets and not think about it, you know. So my sort of rhythmic and harmonic sense was expanded.
The seriousness with which Frank Zappa takes his music extends to his wide-ranging political causes. Most recently, he gained national attention when he led the battle against the Parents Music Resource Center. Founded by Tipper Gore, this group of prominent Washington women demanded that popular music be rated like movies due to objectionable content. Opposing this attempt towards censorship, Frank Zappa toured the country, voicing his views on radio and television. He also testified before a Senate committee formed to look into the issue.
The reason for this hearing is not to promote any legislation. Indeed, I don't know of any suggestion that any legislation be passed. But to simply provide a forum for airing the issue itself, for ventilating the issue, for bringing it out in the public domain. Senator Hollings?
I've had the opportunity to attend a showing, you might say, a presentation of this pawn rock, as they call it, in the test of pornography. One of the things to look at is that it does not have any redeeming social value. They could be an exception here because, having attended that presentation, the redeeming social value, I find that it's inaudible. I have a hard time understanding it. And Paul, since I traveled the country for 3 years and they said they couldn't understand me, maybe I could make a good rock star. I don't know.
With his uncanny ability to find humor in the most serious matters, Zappa was able to poke fun at the committee by using actual tape transcriptions from a hearing in his piece called Porn Wars from the album Frank Zappa Meets the Mothers of Prevention. Zappa's own flair for the outrageous revealed itself early on. He seemed to revel in the scatological, daring reactionaries to react to such song titles as Half a Dozen Provocative Squats, Why Does It Hurt When I Pee, Take Your Clothes Off When You Dance, and What Is the Ugliest Part of Your Body?
My dick is a monster. Give me your heart.
But my dick is a legend. Enormous thou art.
My dick is a Harley.
But Zappa fans Carl Stone, Charles Armakanian, and Nicholas Leninsky insist the words, however profane, were always an integral part of the expression.
I respect very much his right to speak in whatever language he chooses. And it is not gratuitous. That's something that has to be understood as a method of communication, and especially within the world of rock and roll, the audiences that he makes contact with through the way that he speaks. It's done in an incredibly calculated way. And again, if it's turned to socially beneficial causes such as voter registration, well, I say all the better.
Zappa makes comments about the culture and about society by directly quoting people and throwing in such statements as Valley Girl talk into a piece of music, because he is reflecting culture and giving us a chance to examine it more closely. So his materials are present-day American culture. And his result is a kind of absurdist art form which strikes people as outlandish, but achieves the all-important factor of getting their attention.
After all, Walt Whitman's words were not exactly four-letter words, but they were offensive to people 150 years ago when he wrote Leaves of Grass. I mean, that was denounced as an indecent production that should have never seen print. And it's the same with Zappa.
Although Zappa himself stands to be directly affected by the movement to label rock albums, his concern about any kind of censorship goes much deeper than his own personal interests.
When you see moves towards censorship, this would, in an ideal world, create a situation for somebody who would like to have an authoritarian form of government, create a mechanism that would allow them to further control the release of information and further control any type of dissent that might upset their apple cart. And with Americans, there's always that possibility. This is a very unpredictable nation here, because just when you think that everybody's got their head in the sand, just when you think that it is all over, that they've been completely bamboozled, that it's been proven before, they'll snap, and they will wake up, and they will make demands. And I think that the people in the enemy camp realize that this is always a possibility, that something could wake the Americans up. And when Americans wake up, they're dangerous. And especially dangerous to people who have this, fascistic kind of system that they want to install. So anytime you see somebody seeking to control the arts or to control commentary, you should get suspicious. I mean, history is full of examples of how other people have tried to do this and where it led. The sneaky part about censorship in America is not whether or not they will actually set up a board to go over every lyric on every record. The censorship is already there. The censorship is there at the broadcast level, at the MTV level, at the executive level in the record companies. Certain people don't get signed. If they do get signed, they can't say certain things. If they take the chance and put that certain thing on the record, that record's not going on the air. It's not going on MTV. You've already been shut out. Considering the fact that I've been doing this kind of stuff for 25 years, have many songs that are absolutely anti-drug. Did they ever get programmed on a radio station? Never.
Now what kind of a guru are you anyway?
Frank Zappa continues to write music that doesn't fit into the mainstream of popular culture. Both musically and politically, he stands for the rights of the individual. Composer Carl Stone.
That's a very admirable quality, regardless of whether or not you believe the same way as he does on any issue. And the fact of the matter is that he's very outspoken and forthright in his opinions, and he does stick by them. And he's used his position as a kind of celebrity in the rock and roll world to command attention. And it's, I think, been, in my opinion, generally for socially beneficial causes. He's involved in voter registration, and I happen to agree with him regarding the whole issue of stickering for record album labels, where he's taken a strong stand, and other political issues as well. Well, he always has been very involved socially. The means of communication has been as a rock and roll star, and that potentially is dangerous. One could sink into sheer demagoguery. But I think that basically he's been quite responsible.
From his very earliest work with the Mothers of Invention, Frank Zappa has followed his own set of rules. When he and the band released their first album, called Freak Out, a Columbia executive flatly stated it had no commercial potential. But then Zappa was to create a niche for himself that no existing record company could accommodate, forcing him eventually to create his own label, Barking Pumpkin, and his own distribution company.
She could mutate insanely. She could mutate insanely.
That's right. You know, she could go on the freeway and grow up to be 15 feet tall and scary looking. And then cars could crash all over the place as a result of people with white shirts on.
I didn't have any choice, because if I had been any other kind of performer doing any other kind of music, it might have made more sense just to keep my mouth shut and stay with a record company, because, you know, they'll make you a star and, you know, you'd have all that star stuff. And there's hardly any work involved. All you gotta do is go in the studio every once in a while, sing your nice little song, and then periodically go on tour and sell a bunch of t-shirts. But I wasn't cut out for that, so I had to do it another way.
Zappa runs Barking Pumpkin with his wife, Gail. He prepares the product, writing liner notes and ads and supervising the packaging. She works during the day, dealing with vendors, bankers, the administrative details. And he very often toils through the night, writing music, editing, and recording. These countless hours of work have honed Zappa's musical skills to an extraordinary degree.
He can hear amazing things that many of us don't recognize.
Charles Armakanian.
But to do that and to have that talent is one that a person develops, as well as having an innate ability to perform. So I think that he's sharpened his hearing by his own very hard work. Zappa doesn't do much besides composing. He's a full-time devotee of music. He doesn't do it between semesters or in the summers when he's off from teaching. He's doing it all the time. And the total time that he spent composing and working on pieces of music and refining them and then recording them and realizing them electronically and in the recording studio, if you added those hours end to end, would surpass the lifetimes of five or six much more respected, you could say, composers in the field of orchestral music in this country.
Is a famous rock and roll star and blues guitarist.
David Auker.
And that overshadows the notion of Frank Zappa, a serious modern composer. No new music composer, I can't think of an example, somebody really makes their living just by writing music. Most composers teach or write commercial music. Frank just happens to be a rock and roll star. He makes his living by being a rock and roll star and uses that money to fund his music.
There is one aspect of Frank Zappa's life that he treats with as much dedication as his music. He's the devoted father of four children, whose individuality he fervently supports, even down to their names, Moon Unit, Dweezil, Amit, and Diva. All in all, Zappa lives simply. In his autobiography, The Real Frank Zappa Book, Zappa writes, "I don't have any time for social activities. I do, however, have a wonderful wife and four unbelievable children, and that, folks, is way better." It's not exactly a typical attitude for a rock star, especially one who specializes in the outrageous. Carl Stone and Nicholas Leninsky.
I think that one aspect of Frank Zappa does love absurdity, but I think that he rejects the notion that he's any more bizarre than another public figure. I mean, I heard him once on the radio. Someone was gushing about, "Oh, Frank Zappa, you're so bizarre, you're so weird, what is it about you that makes you this way? And he turned around and said, well, I mean, compare me to Michael Jackson, you know, a guy who's had, you know, 27 plastic surgeries and, you know, bought the skeleton of the Elephant Man and, you know, has a zoo in his backyard, and do you think that I'm any more absurd than that? It's a very good point.
What's new in Baltimore?
The newest port in all of Baltimore.
Hey, what's new in Baltimore? What's new in Baltimore?
Frank Zappa belongs to the second part of the 20th century. He belongs to the United States of America, and that he could not have happened in any other country at any other time. He's known everywhere, and this is, in a way, a victory for Varese, Zappa, rock and roll, and me. You know, it's a very strange combination.
Frank Zappa's devotion to music is indefatigable. In the absence of any kind of tangible feedback about their most serious works, most people would give it up entirely. Zappa just keeps on going.
I'm not waiting for somebody to tell me I'm doing a good job, because I've realized that, especially if you're a prolific composer, no one has the time to listen to what you did. I've got more music in there than anybody could ever stand to listen to. They couldn't stand it. That's no reason not to do it. But I certainly won't pretend that I think that it's fine that things are that way. I think that it is very unfortunate, not just from my standpoint, but from the standpoint of anybody who spends his life writing music. You know, this is very grim.
So what keeps you going?
It's all I know how to do. And I enjoy doing it. So if I have the equipment that will do it, if I enjoy doing it, I have the time to do it, then why shouldn't I do it? Even if you never hear it, what's the difference? I get to hear it. I'm having a good time. Other than that, what do you expect out of life?
Barking Pumpkin, The Life and Times of Frank Zappa, is a production of KUSC, the broadcast service of the University of Southern California. Funding was provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with additional support from the American Public Radio Program Fund. Please send us your comments on this program. Our address is Barking Pumpkin, KUSC, Los Angeles, California, 90007. Again, Barking Pumpkin, KUSC, Los Angeles, 90007. Barking Pumpkin, The Life and Times of Frank Zappa, was produced by Lucia DeLisa. Audio engineering was provided by Fred Vogler. Post-production, Ted Ancona. Our special thanks to John Stout, Gene Parrish, Susan Taylor, and Bill Utvich for their contributions to this program. This is your host and co-producer, Gail Eichenthal. Thanks for listening.